further, I realize that this probably isn't going to work. You may be wondering, as I have been, if I'm justified in taking a whole sermon in introduction. But I take a little courage in seeing that one of the commentaries that I read by Gene L. Green devoted a full 20% of his book to the introduction. I'm quite sure that mine will be less than that. But as I was reading through these books and looking over the themes in these books, I realized that it will be important to do two things. First, we will have to bridge that massive cultural chasm between us and first century Macedonia. Remember that it's been said, and reasonably so, I think, that culture at the beginning of the last century had more in common with first century Greco-Roman culture than it has with our own culture. So bridging that chasm takes disciplined thinking and an open mind. Secondly, in order to mine these letters for what they're worth, to receive from them what God intends for our generation, we need to understand both the similarities and the differences between our context and that of the Thessalonians. The differences may not surprise us, but perhaps the similarities will. Speaking of differences, I'm finding that it is a real switch to study these letters from studying the Gospel of John. Obviously, the content is different, but the personalities of the writers is also quite different, as is their style of writing. And we also need to keep in mind that Greek and Jewish cultures, the cultures of Macedonia and Palestine or Judea, are also very distinct. I'm not sure what comparison to use, but maybe it's like the difference between the U.S. and El Salvador, or maybe even a greater difference than that, I'm not sure. So, if you can bear with the teacher side of me, I'm going to be heavy on information this morning, heavier than on inspiration, I'm afraid. But I'm praying that the Spirit can use this to prepare us for the heart, for the heart-changing and life-changing message that he has for us in these two letters. I'll start with a general history and description of Thessalonica and Macedonia, and then look at how the church at Thessalonica began. I don't know if I'm right in doing this, but I have to warn you, I am going to be doing a lot of quoting this morning. I have to confess that until I started studying this, I knew precious little about Macedonia. Now, I suspect that all of us can think about something distinctive about any of the 50 states in our country. At least I hope we can. How many of you could do that for, say, even one state in the country of Mexico? A few of you. Good for you. I can't. And that's how Macedonia was to me. Here is a map of the Roman Empire in 125 AD. The red area is the province of Macedonia. And province was somewhat equivalent to a state, but don't take that too far. The Adriatic Sea is to the west, and the Aegean Sea is to the southeast. here is a close-up. You can see some of the mountain ranges here in and also kind of the plain there around Thessalonica. In social studies at Pilgrim, we have the goal of helping students understand how the natural features of a land shape the culture of its inhabitants. I'll mention a bit more about that later. You will recognize a few city names on this map. Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea are all in the province of Macedonia. And Corinth and Athens are two names you'll recognize from the province of Achaia. There is one more important feature of this region that impacts particularly the history of Thessalonica. You've probably heard of the Appian Way, the famous road in Rome, and the first of its kind. It was built in 312 BC and was 132 miles long. The Via Egnatia, if I'm pronouncing that right, the Via Egnatia was built 150 years later and was twice as long. That's the red line on this map. Note that it goes right through Thessalonica and that it ends at the east end in Byzantium, which is the site of modern-day Istanbul. This road was much more critical to the welfare of the Roman Empire and the provinces it ran through than any interstate roadway is in the U.S. today. Interestingly, this road was only 10 to 12 feet wide in most places, and it even narrowed down to 6 feet at times. Here is one of the few intact sections left of the original road, now over 2,200 years old, 20, something like that. This one is in Albania at the west end of the route. In addition to being ideally located on the Via Egnatia, Thessalonica was perfectly situated as a port city on the Thermaic Gulf, I think I'm saying that right, protected from violent winds that make sailing so treacherous on the seas of this region. Looking now at the political background of Macedonia, our first reference point is centuries before the time of Christ. Who can tell me who the most well-known Macedonian figure is, historic figure is?
Alexander the Great.
We think of his empire as having been a Greek empire, but it would be just as accurately called, or more correctly called, the Macedonian Empire. His father established that empire, but he greatly extended it. Here is a concise summary of the impact of his conquest from BibleHistory.com. Alexander the Great's empire broke in pieces almost immediately after his death, yet the effects of his battles have remained to all time. One great result was the Hellenizing of every land that he conquered and their assimilation to the Greek civilization, Greek ideas, and Greek way of life. The Greek language became the tongue of all government and literature throughout many countries where the people were not Greek by birth. It was thus, at the very moment that Greece began to lose her political freedom, that she made, as it were, an intellectual conquest of a large part of the world. Here is a comparison between the landmass of Alexander's empire and the Roman Empire at its height. I couldn't find a map with both of them on it, so I scaled these to make them comparable. You'll see there that the Greek Empire landmass is quite a bit more, actually, than the Roman Empire. After Alexander died at the age of 32, the empire was divided among four of his generals. Antipater ruled Macedonia and Greece. That was in 323 BC. For the next 175 years, Macedonia prospered economically and politically. The country, and especially the capital city, Thessalonica, were very well positioned for prospering. In addition to its prime location as a port, the city was very well situated with natural resources. The fertile plain produced grain crops and continental fruits, not like the Mediterranean climate. The forested mountains gave lots of timber. There was an abundance of water for fishing. And incredibly, there were mines of gold, silver, copper, lead, and iron. However, when Rome conquered Macedonia after three hard wars in the second century BC, Rome very effectively crippled the economy of this former powerhouse by closing the mines and restricting trade between the districts within the province. In spite of Roman conquest, though, Macedonia continued to embrace a very distinct cultural identity. Even 200 years later, with close beneficial ties to Rome, Macedonians still maintained Greek as their primary language. Now, I know this is sounding like a social studies lesson, but this is building to some important stuff. I mentioned that Macedonia had beneficial ties to Rome. Let me expand on that a bit. Macedonia was a province of the Roman Empire. Generally, there were two kinds of provinces: imperial, which is related to the word empire, and senatorial. If a province behaved well, it might become a senatorial province. In fact, if a city did well enough, it could become a free city and not even have to pay taxes to Rome. But if the province was troublesome, it was designated as an imperial province and was more heavily occupied by the Roman military and, I presume, also more heavily taxed. Any ideas which one Judea might have been? Well, Macedonia had the good fortune of being a senatorial province at the time of Paul. In fact, Thessalonica was granted the free city status as well. This was a critical factor in the comfort and prosperity of its citizens. And a position that they did not take lightly, and with good reason. Think about the oppressive conditions of the Jewish masses languishing in Palestine. The good life that the Thessalonians enjoyed could easily be lost if the powers that be, and especially the emperor, became displeased with them. This brings us to a social structure of the time that was also political and economic. It was called patronage. Green quotes a Wallace Hedrill when he says, "Patronage was central to the structure of Roman society as feudalism was to medieval. It constituted the dominant social relationship between ruler and the ruled." This is foreign to the ideals of modern democracy, but people with political power in the Roman Empire were not expected to be even-handed. Green says the emperor was considered the patron above all others, and he was far from being an administrator who distributed goods and privileges to all members of the society equally. Green continues, the general expectation was that public officials, especially the emperor, would use their power in favor of those who were closest to them. Now let's pause here a bit. Would you say that this is similar to or different from our experience in the U.S.? Well, it certainly is not a part of my conscious daily experience, but I submit that the U.S. operates with this structure under a different name. What would you call it? Lobbying. For those of you who aren't familiar with this term, lobbyists are people who represent special interests, often private interests, to lawmakers. For example, a big firm might contribute to a senator's campaign fund to encourage the senator to introduce a bill that would create a tax loophole for this company's industry. And yes, this happens on both the right and the left. If you want some nauseating food for thought, ask me and I can get you some details. Sure, this approach is foreign to the ideals of democracy, but perhaps any democracy will inevitably deteriorate to the practice of lobbying because of the inherent selfishness of both the governed and the governing. I say that in this respect, our culture and the culture of ancient Rome are not identical, but similar. Now, keep this patronage thing in mind as we look at religion in ancient Macedonia. First of all, remember that in Roman culture, the expectation was that everybody worshipped many gods. It was no threat to introduce a new god to the mix. If you need that god to get what you want in life, go for it. And interestingly enough, how people interacted with their gods was not so much different from the way they interacted with their patrons. I will honor and flatter and make strong statements about you if you do this or that for me. Of course, sacrifice was also important, as was avoiding or appeasing this god's anger. Here's where it gets interesting. You may remember that it was rather common in this time, and actually for centuries before this, for rulers to consider themselves divine and for the people that were, you know, wanting to butter them up to call them divine. But Caesar Augustus gave this practice kind of a whole new level of respectability. So now a city or a province would not only eagerly honor the emperor as a brilliant ruler, for example, it would revere him as a god. To do otherwise was to incur his wrath and lose his favor. Are you seeing the pattern here? Quoting again from Green. In the Greek worldview, the line between the human and the divine was fuzzy. The gods were viewed as little more than beings elevated somewhat above humans because of their great virtues and immortality. Therefore, those humans who did those things that appeared divine could expect corresponding honors. Allow me to pause again for a comparison with our culture. On the face of it, this is a point where modern Western culture clearly has taken a different turn, right? But I ask you, is it really all that different? When you consider, in general, how little credit we give deity, meaning a supernatural god, and how much credit we give some humans, I'm not sure that there is all that much difference. Green says further, Moreover, the distinction between honors and adoration was not clearly marked. I have to say, if I look at the U.S. as a whole, and even to the Christian church in the U.S., I think I see a lot more adoration given to humans than I do to deity. Think about the fanatic adulation of musicians, actors, athletes, politicians, at least some of them. Don't you think it could rival the orgies of ancient Macedonians, or that ancient Macedonians engaged in to express devotion to or supplication for their mythical gods and human patrons? And is the motivation that much different? Green says of that era, the relationship with the gods was viewed as a transaction. Do this for me, and I'll do that for you. How much different is our society? I'm afraid I see some similarity on this one. Let's take this a little further. Michael Holmes observes, key elements of this religious activity were closely associated with civic and political concerns. In the ancient world, religion was always closely linked to politics because dominant social groups realized that religion offered an effective means to legitimize and maintain their power and dominance. Now, that's a mouthful, but did you follow that? In Thessalonica, city leaders fostered devotion to the imperial cult, that just means worshiping the emperor, in order to solidify good relations with Rome. He goes on to say that equally important to the Thessalonians was the worship of their local god, Cabirus. So the Christians, these new converts, who not only worshiped another god, but made exclusive claims about their god, were viewed as a serious threat to the political and economic welfare of the city. In such an environment, to preach Christianity was tantamount to treason, he says. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? I'm seeing another comparison. The Thessalonian believers were seen as a huge threat because they weren't doing their patriotic duty to curry the emperor's favor. Their lack of participation jeopardized the entire city. In the case of Nebuchadnezzar and the three Hebrew young men, they were only endangering their own lives by not worshiping the king. But in Thessalonica, such a move was seen as endangering the entire city. My understanding of this is that it was just as bad not to worship the emperor or the local gods as it would have been to refuse to join the army if your city was caught in armed conflict. You follow? If worship was so closely linked with political action, am I right in saying that our situation is unnervingly similar? Oh, we certainly wouldn't couch it in those terms. But isn't the pressure there to do what is good politically for the nation or the city, if you please? Look again at that quote. I've tweaked it slightly. Here is a similarity that grieves me. In our time as well, I believe, religion is closely linked to politics because dominant social groups realize that religion offers an effective means to legitimize and maintain their power and dominance. Brothers and sisters, I say that is not the way of Christ. Now, I do note one difference. The religion referred to here was the worship of false gods. What do you call the emperor? I don't know. In our context, I see an attempted linking of religion of the one true God to politics. And again, it happens on both the right and the left. I pray that the courageous example of the Thessalonians will compel us to reject this linking. There is a proper linking, and Paul talks about it in 1 Timothy 2. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good, and it is pleasing in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. Please note that according to this, the goal of our prayers for political leaders is not so that we can get our way or so that we can be more comfortable. Derek Prince observes the goal of our prayers is first so that the leaders may do their job well, because if they do, we can live lives that please God. Prince further sees the implication in verse 4 that when we live lives as described here, people will be saved and come to knowledge of the truth. I believe that makes sense. Well, there's a lot more that could be discussed about this, but I guess we'll have to do that afterward. But check out my logic. See if what I've said makes sense. And if I'm not seeing it right, I want to know. Now, turn to Acts 15, if you please. This is where we get most of the biblical context for these letters. Okay, I'm starting to read at verse 36. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaimed the word of the Lord and see how they are." Now Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord, and he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Well, that wasn't too comfortable a start for the second trip, but there they were. Notice, though, that both teams ended up visiting towns from their first trip to accomplish what Paul was setting out to do. They had started in Cyprus, where Barnabas and John Mark went, and then had returned to the mainland, which is where Paul and Silas now went. Here is a map of their route, roughly speaking. Let's start reading in verse 1 of chapter 16. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra. A disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. As they went on their way through the cities, they delivered to them for observance the decisions that had been reached by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem. So the churches were strengthened in the faith, and they increased in numbers daily. And they went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. And when they had come to Mysia, They attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of the Lord did not allow them. So passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing there urging him and saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." And when Paul had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go on into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. Have you ever wondered how it must have felt to these missionaries to have traveled most of the way to the Black Sea, only to discover that they didn't have any business there? I have the feeling I might have been frustrated. Anyway, they now have their directions, and these are pretty significant. This is now not the equivalent of our going, say, to Missouri or even Pennsylvania. I think it's more like going to Europe. And did you notice the change in verse 10 from they to we? We don't have any explanation, but Luke had now joined them. Let's keep reading. So, setting sail from Troas, we made a direct voyage to Samothrace, and the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. We remained in this city some days. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had come together. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple goods, who was a worshiper of God. The Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. After she was baptized and her household as well, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. The rest of this chapter tells of their experience in Philippi. That was their first stop in Macedonia. It was quite an initiation to Macedonia. We'll start reading again in chapter 17, but take another look at this map. Notice that they were now right on the Via Egnatia and would be heading west. Again, this was the major artery of this part of the Roman Empire, and it would have been heavily traveled. I'll quote again from Green. "The apostles found themselves alongside Roman soldiers and officials, people involved in trade, Roman colonists, religious heralds, philosophers, pilgrims, and other travelers, all members of a society that had become extremely mobile. The great success of Thessalonica was due in grand part to the union of land and sea, road and port, which facilitated commerce between Macedonia and the entire Roman Empire. No other place in all Macedonia offered the strategic advantages of Thessalonica, a fact not lost on the Christian heralds." Cicero, an acclaimed orator of the day, called Macedonia the heart of the Roman Empire. They were jumping right into the middle of Macedonian life. Here again is a map of their route a little more up close. I've made one correction on this map. Acts 17:14 says that when things got ugly in Berea, the brothers sent Paul to the coast, which makes me think he went to Athens by water. So I've marked an orange path in there, roughly representing where he went. Let's read now at chapter 17, verse 1. "Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ, the Anointed One, to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, 'This Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ.' And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews were jealous, and taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring him out of the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, 'These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has received them. and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. And the people and the authorities, city authorities, were disturbed when they heard these things. And when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea, and when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. It's not hard to see why the Jews were quick to react negatively to the conversion of their own. Well, we too would be distressed if evangelists of another religion successfully siphoned from away from us, people away from our own faith. But think back to the case I was making for the critical role that worship of the gods and the emperor played here. Does it make more sense now why the coming of the gospel was so disturbing? And notice it wasn't just the people. The city authorities were also alarmed. This new movement wasn't simply adding another god to the multitudes they already had. 1 Thessalonians 1:9 confirms what we already know. Paul said, the word had come back to via other believers in Macedonia and Achaia that the Thessalonians had, quote, turned from idols to serve the living and true God. This new religion was radical to the Thessalonians. It denounced all the gods that the Thessalonians worked so hard to please. This was a direct attack on Thessalonian unity and solidarity, on social stability. And if that weren't enough, it wasn't just the gods that were being threatened. Caesar himself, they thought, was in the crosshairs. Verse 7, they were saying, there is another God, there is another king, Jesus. They were, of course, dreadfully mistaken. But their alarm is understandable, I think. It may be worth noting here that if we stitch the story together, it seems apparent that they were in Thessalonica for more than those three Sabbath days that they spent in the synagogue. There are a variety of opinions on the matter, but it seems reasonable to me to think that they were there for several months before they were expelled. This will be relevant when we get to chapter 2 in Thessalonians. Now, as a wrap-up, I'd like to point out the converts we know by name from Thessalonica. There are only a few, but I'd like to look at them. Turn to Acts 19:21. Paul is now on his third missionary journey, and this time he was able to go to Asia. He had spent almost 3 years in Ephesus. We get that from his farewell address in Acts 20. Here is a map of that third route, or that third trip, or that route on his third trip. Let's read now verse 21. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. Now, we'll skip over the speech that sparked the riot, but let's jump in again at verse 28. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. So we know that Gaius and Aristarchus were Macedonians. We'll see more about them both later. After the let's read again in verse, well, I should just say that marks the end of Paul's time in Ephesus, and it seems that Aristarchus and Gaius must have left as well. Let's read again now in chapter 20, verse 1. After the uproar ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, he said farewell and departed for Macedonia. When he had gone through those regions and had given them much encouragement, he came to Greece. There he spent 3 months, and when a plot was made against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Sopater, the Berean, son of Pyrrhus, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus, there it is, and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy, and the Asians, Tychicus and Trophimus. These went on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas, but we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days we came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days. I see something worth noting here. Aristarchus and Secundus, and the others for that matter, had gone from never having heard the gospel to being tenacious propagators of the good news in less than 5 years. In regions well beyond their home city, and all that in the face of severe opposition. Aristarchus stayed with Paul all the way to Jerusalem, apparently never leaving through all that drama of the next several years, including the 2 years that Paul spent imprisoned in Caesarea. When Festus sent Paul to Rome, Aristarchus and Luke accompanied him there. From both Paul's letter to the Colossians and his letter to Philemon, we see that Aristarchus was loyal through and through. He accepted imprisonment rather than abandoning Paul. Colossians 4:10, Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you have received instructions, if he comes to you, welcome him. And from Philemon 23 and 24, Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ, sends greetings to you, and so do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, my fellow workers. You'll remember Jason, the apostle's host, when they first came to Thessalonica. He also traveled for the sake of the gospel. We just read in chapter 20 that Paul stayed in Corinth for 3 months. Based on what we read in Romans 15, we can deduce that he wrote the letter to the Romans during this stay. Paul conveys his greetings from Jason in 16:21, so we see that Jason's vision led him to work with Paul in Corinth. We'll dig into this more later, but these who were named were clearly not the only converts in Thessalonica to have been constrained to spread the good news. Listen to 1 Thessalonians 1:8. Paul says, "For not only has the word of the Lord sounded forth from you in Macedonia and Achaia, but your faith in God has gone forth everywhere, so that we need not say anything." At the risk of over-repetition, I want to remind you that these were people who had been believers for only a few years, and with the persecution, would have had every reason to excuse themselves for hunkering down a bit and, you know, waiting for the dust to settle, or maybe to get some more training or something. I don't know what to do with this, except just to accept the challenge. I know that we're not all gifted as evangelists. I certainly don't feel like I am. I know that many of us in the U.S. have already heard the gospel. I know that many are hardened to it. But I think there is something wrong with our faith, something anemic about our Christian life, if we don't have a passion for sharing Christ's love and truth to those we interact with who aren't believers. And I don't know how to factor in all the changes from the early church to now, but I do know that the Great Commission hasn't changed. And no, we're not Galileans, but I don't think Jesus would have reworded that for us to say, "And you will be my witnesses in Partridge and in all Hutchinson and South Hutchinson and to the ends of Reno County." What does that mean? I am not going to attempt an exact answer for that, but may God show each of us how the power of the gospel should change the course of our next week, our next year, our next decade. Let's bow for prayer. Lord, I come to this study of the letters to the Thessalonians with the confidence that the truths that you revealed through Paul by your Spirit to the Thessalonians have distinct relevance for us today. But we really need your wisdom, Lord, in knowing how to understand this, because we're not the original audience. But if you preserved it for us, Lord, I fully expect that by your Spirit, you will preserve the meaning, the application for us as well. Lord, you know the heart of everybody who's listening today. You know my heart. You heard our confession, our seeking your face at the beginning of the service here. We look to you, God, to faithfully continue your work in our lives as we leave here today. In Jesus' name, amen.